Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast. Welcome to what hopefully sounds like a much cooler New Statesman podcast, because great update from the pod catacomb. After months of you, Stephen, having to kind of man spread uncomfortably around a really horribly shaped table, we've now got a circular table.
Yeah.
So I can gaze at you with my beady eye throughout everything that you're saying. I want to start by talking about Prime Minister's questions, and we'll move on to our main topic, but I just want to have a moment.
A moment to everyone. Oh, actually, I can't remember the tune to Bow Down, but if I could, I would sing it about Emily Thornberry.
Yeah, so David Lidington, who's leader of the House, stood in for Theresa May because she's off in the Gulf at a gathering with even more men than she's used to when she goes to Tory party receptions. But that meant that Jeremy Corbyn also got a week off. Emily Thornberry stood in. And, I mean, David Lidington did okay. Let's first of all give some mild props to David Lidington, right? Who had a very sticky hand to play and mostly kept his cool really well. But Emily Thornberry did all six questions to go, so are we staying in the customs union? And he'd go like, whoa, you don't accept the referendum result. And she'd go, yeah, we do. Are we staying in the customs union, though? I just thought it was a really effective performance.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a Route 1 PMQ's performance, but obviously there's a reason why that is the first route. David Lidington had this problem, and as you pointed out, Raphael Baer said on Twitter, like, he hasn't been told what he thinks about the customs union by the Prime Minister. He kind of got a bit ratty, and she definitely went. I think one of the things I would like to talk about is the fact that most of the parliamentary lobby...
Oh, is it going to be the shade-throwing section?
...is surprised by the fact that an eminent barrister who has employed Damien McBride, who, you know, did some fairly dodgy things, but, you know, a key player in one of the most, you know, the most prolonged and successful period of non-conservative government in British history since the 18th century, people are surprised that she did PMQs well.
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting thing about her when she was doing defence, is that she said, well, actually, I think there's a good argument to be made against Trident, because why are we putting all this money into a nuclear deterrent when we should be putting much more money into cyber defence? And everyone was like, pop, 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 pop.
And now Donald Trump is president.
Yeah, and then obviously the whole year has been dominated by, hey, where are all these mysterious WikiLeaks dumps that, you know, only incriminate the person that the Russians don't want in the White House? I think there's big worries for Angela Merkel in Germany that she might be subject to the same kind of thing, you know? And
you've got to hope she's got two-step verification turned on.
Yeah, I really hope that she hasn't just been using like 12345 password as her password, because that she's lost the election at that point.
Yeah.
You know, what an incredibly effective destabilizing tactic selective leaking, selective hacking is.
Yeah.
So she was absolutely right on that. And I agree with you. In the safe space of the podcast, we can say that I just think she reminds middle-class men of when their wife asked them to empty the dishwasher. And the people who write about politics, that group is heavily overrepresented there.
Yeah, I think that is exactly it. And I also think there is a wider issue than that, and we've touched on it before, but I think one of the reasons why Conservatives have produced two female prime ministers and Labour have produced none is there is an idea of Conservative womanhood. It is very limited, right? It's, you know, it's like doing a not very good Elizabeth I impression. But if you can ride that impression to the top of the party, then that works for you, right? That is an acceptable model.
Yeah, it's kind of almost like Virgin Queen mixed with a slight overtone of kind of sadomasochism. Right? Yeah. You see all this sort of stuff about Thatcher, you see the thing about her handbagging men, and that you kind of see the same tropes used about Theresa May, the idea that she's, you know, she's got these icy glances, you know, she really puts people in their place. So it's a kind of this sort of cold, hard power sort of idea. But you're right, there is no...
Yeah.
I think actually something that... when I was doing my motherhood thing, actually, one of the senior Labour MPs said to me, you know, is that there's no model of what a big beast is when you're a woman, right? You're used to talking in Labour about big beasts. Well, actually, that's really kind of alpha dominant men.
Yeah.
You can't be a lady beast.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that I find deeply maddening in the Corbyn era is you'll have a situation where Diane Abbott or Emily Thornberry will go on television and they will give a kind of eloquent and fairly well-expressed version of the leadership's policy, right?
Mm.
Now, in some cases, I think the leadership's policy is fairly bonkers and incoherent, but people don't go, oh, that was bonkers and incoherent from John McDonnell. They go, oh, Labour are never going to win with that policy. Whereas Diane comes up and sums up what Labour's position on something is, and everyone's just like, oh, rogue performance. Oh, who's this lunatic woman and why has she wandered onto my TV set? And you see this with Emily Thornberry as well, like, you know, you can have an argument about whether or not people are going to elect a party which is anti-Trident. But her argument for it, so for being opposed to it, is very good and it's expressed in a very eloquent way. It's just people don't like it when it comes from a posh lady.
I do think there is just a general problem of female authority. And you're right, I think that the Tories have kind of solved that by this sort of Gloriana way of doing it, which is a kind of... You implicitly make the argument that you're an exceptional, you know, I have not the heart of a weak and feeble woman, I have the stomach of a king, or whatever, I've got my organs confused in that. But it's basically, you're not arguing that all women are brilliant, you're arguing that you are exceptional. And I think that's less inherently destabilising than saying, yeah, I think all women should be, you know, our leader, and actually we should have loads of women in the cabinet too, which is kind of like, oh, let's not get crazy with this tokenism. I thought it was a really accomplished performance. And I also thought, you know, actually, it was a really revealing performance because it reveals that the government won't tell us what it wants from its deal. And whether or not you think it's reasonable to do that, that is a kind of useful fact to know. I think they're in real trouble because I think everyone is getting a bit angsty about not having had any details, about even about kind of broad priorities, right? And that's why they had to accept Labour's amendment saying that they would lay out more details. I mean, I think those details, when they're forthcoming, will probably still not satisfy everybody.
And this is a big example of hindsight being 2020, because I was not saying, oh, Keir Starmer should have asked for a white paper, not a plan, before he did it. The difficulty with asking for a plan is whether or not it means that the government can get away with coming out with a very banal set of principles and going, oh, here's our plan.
We want the best deal for Britain.
Yeah, oh, that's our plan, in heavy inverted commas. But I think you're right in that if she had had an Article 50 vote first week in the job... Yeah, it would have passed. If it hadn't passed, it would have been because it had gotten into difficulties in the Lords. They'd have then been able to dismember the anti-Conservative majority over there, which they hate anyway. It's win-win. Whereas by having this pointless ongoing battle, I mean, I have spoken to no lawyer, right, regardless of how they felt about the referendum, who privately thinks that the government is going to get anything other than a hiding in the Supreme Court, because they're like, well, they've got a strong moral case. However, in terms of the actual workings of the law, Article 50 will destroy a lot of rights, so obviously it's reserved to the legislature, not the executive.
It's also, to me, feels like a very weird battle to pick, because I don't see any evidence that there isn't a majority for passing a simple Article 50 bill in the Commons, right? So what you're basically doing is having this massive argument about how you hate all judges, trying to destroy the independence of the courts because you don't like what they're saying, only to end up with the result that you wanted in the end anyway.
Yeah, and obviously we don't know what the judgment will be, but... There is a risk to the government that they end up with a verdict which sharply limits prerogative power more than they would like. ED is arguing that you can basically assume that unless Parliament has explicitly said something is not a prerogative power, it is. So he's effectively arguing from the sound of silence. I'm sorry, I don't know why I did that. But
it's beautiful. That's like the God of the Gaps theory, yeah. Isn't it? That actually your kind of rationale for God is all the things you can't explain are God. But yeah. In his case, all the things you can't explain are Brexit.
Yeah, which is arguable. However, that would give the executive quite a lot of power. I don't think they're going to get that. But their risk is if the Supreme Court comes back and goes, not only are you not getting that, but we think from this case X, Y, and Z. And then that opens up a whole suite of possible claims people can make about overweening executive power. It's just a really odd battle to have fought.
Yeah, when you kind of don't need to. I am baffled by their approach. And I think it does go back to that conversation that we've been having all year, actually, about whether or not Theresa May is good or lucky. And I think on the evidence so far that she's still, it's still an open question because she's still being extremely lucky. She's still got an opposition that are trailing her by, what is it, 13, 14 points on average?
It's settled down to kind of 7 to 10 now.
Yeah, a mere 7 to 10. But, you know, who are also having their own total internal wrangle over Europe, but given that they're fighting off UKIP in one set of seats and Lib Dems another set of seats, and one day they might dream of having a seat, more than one seat in Scotland again. She has certainly been incredibly lucky with that. But again, the problem is you can only kind of play the tune of Labour don't have an answer so much. No one expects Labour to have an answer. That's the problem. If you're, again, it's the sort of thing of being priced in. If it's priced in that Labour are weak and they're not going to be the government, then unfortunately people are going to expect you to have the answer.
Yeah.
And they kind of don't.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And together we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can get this episode and everything else we've done on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time to go down the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So 2 years ago, MPs felt the electoral ground shift beneath them as a series of polls showed the SNP surging on the back of the independence referendum. And of course, they went on to win 56 of the 59 Scottish seats. 40 Labour MPs, 10 Liberal Democrats were swept away. And after the Richmond by-election, Labour and Tory MPs are worried that the ground is once more moving. So we saw the Lib Dems take that seat by turning it into a referendum on Brexit and ousting the pro-Leave Zach Goldsmith. Tory MPs are worried that they could do the same in other seats with large Remain voters. And Labour are after the election of Paul Nuttall, who's made it his stated ambition to replace Labour as the party of opposition. So no small task. Are worried that UKIP could take seats and votes off them by similarly running on a Brexit platform, by turning themselves into the party of Leave.
It's particularly troubling for Labour in that the Conservative leadership has basically made a bid to be the main party of Leave. The UKIP obviously are trying to have a Brexit betrayal myth, but no one is really certain what it is that Labour should do. Where is the leadership on the Brexit issue at the moment?
Yes, so in favour of a soft Brexit, essentially. You saw Emily Thornberry at PMQs with the other Labour's now committed to customs union membership. They will be tabling amendments on the single market when any Brexit-related legislation comes forward. But you're right that their position isn't clear to the public at large. Of course, what distinguishes Labour from the other parties is they are the opposition. They are the only party that could plausibly form a government in the near future. UKIP have one MP, the Lib Dems have eight MPs. But with the party so divided, and with Jeremy Corbyn having such poor personal ratings, it's hard for Labour to offer themselves as an alternative government. So I think that's the problem for them. And it's also, there are also structural factors at play here, that this is a less tribal, less class-based era. People don't define themselves by their work anymore. They often define themselves more by their identity. That helps parties like the Lib Dems and UKIP, as opposed to Labour. And there is a gnawing sense that Labour MPs have that they are the party of the past rather than the party of the future. Trade union membership, public sector workforce, both far smaller than they were in the past. And if you look across Europe, everywhere centre-left social democratic parties are in structural decline, not just cyclical decline. It's not just the case of a few bad election results. They are polling terribly everywhere.
In terms of that grim vista, obviously the leadership is not social democratic and they wouldn't really self-describe in that way. They were feeling much chirpier after the Trump result in terms of what they felt it showed about the 2020 election. Is that still the case or has that optimism dissipated slightly?
Yes, it has. It has dissipated, and that's inevitable because the polls have been, as Corbyn ally John Trickett told a recent meeting at the NEC, dire. And he said that at the next election, Labour would have to defend some seats. It wouldn't just be able to put its resources into targeting gains from the Conservatives and others. I think the hope is that the Tories will still come unstuck over Brexit, that actually, whether you're for Remain or for Leave, that's less important than simply the government doing a bad job, the economy going badly. Labour say, look, we cannot simply stand up for the 48% or the 52%. We have to try and speak to everyone. We want to talk about the kind of country we want to see, the reforms we want to make. We'll focus on the economy, on jobs, on living standards, which is in many ways an echo of what Ed Miliband said in 2015. And of course, there we saw Labour marginalises Scotland by the SNP and suffer losses to UKIP as well. They didn't lose any seats directly. But, and here's another fear they have now, UKIP can harm Labour in seats where their main opponents is the Conservatives by taking votes off them. That's the main reason Ed Balls lost his seat, for instance.
Well, on that cheery note, we'll hear from you again next week.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hi, I'm Stephanie.
And I'm John, and we host Skylines, a City Metric podcast, where every 2 weeks we talk about cities, maps and the human world.
Whether the Olympics are good for cities, what it's like to be a woman in a city, and we've had guests like Lauren Elkin, Caroline Criado-Perez.
And Neil Codling, the keyboard player from Suede, because I'm nearly cool now.
Tune in on iTunes or on Acast.
Check it out.
And we're joined by Emily Witt, author of Future Sex, who is here all the way from Trump's America, to talk about the book. Just explain to us in a kind of, what's your, when you say what you wrote the book about, what do you say to people?
The really short answer is I say it's a book about what to do with your sexual freedom, if you have it. and the slightly longer answer is I wanted to write a book that examined a shift that had happened in America demographically, where people were getting married later or not at all, technologically, where we had the internet now and new ways of finding communities and meeting people, and socially a country with greater tolerance and interest in for a diversity of sexual identifications and orientations, and how all of that had shifted our sexual landscape in the past 20 odd years.
And do you think that the sexual landscape has changed more for women? I mean, you write this in a quite a personal tone, but I mean that, you know, that gap now before you kind of settle down, before you have children, before you're kind of, you know, you have those kind of economic burdens, or I'm sure they're pleasures too, having children, but that's something that's particularly affected women's sex lives, hasn't it?
Yeah, there's just much less consensus about what a woman's sexual freedom is supposed to look like. With a man, you have an archetype of the bachelor, you have a whole vocabulary of scoring and all of this, you know, magazines and television shows devoted to the life of the sexually avid single man. And with women, it's just a much more confusing picture. There just isn't, there's a lot of conflicting messages about how you're supposed to be and what you're supposed to want. And so I wanted to try to tell a story of what female sexual freedom can be.
Well, let's talk about porn. I mean, you have a really interesting chapter where you go to Kink's weird, like, castle that they have in San Francisco where they film the Public Disgrace series, which is this one where people basically come and watch in the audience and they kind of sort of slap and spit on the female performers. I thought that was fascinating. I mean, you preface that with a kind of that argument that's been a big line running through feminism. I thought one of the things you said was really interesting, that we're used to saying that the anti-porn feminists lost, but you don't quite think that's the full story. Can you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, because I had never watched porn. I just didn't think it was for me, but I also had this vague idea of it in the back of my mind as something that was bad for women, or misogynistic. And so what I kind of realized is, yeah, the anti-porn feminist movement was a dead end in the sense that they never successfully overrode the First Amendment to ban any kind of pornography. And also, they ran into a dead end in that they could never articulate what a feminist sex would look like with any kind of specificity. But I still think that if, for me as a person raised in a liberal family, that was the trepidation around porn and the worry about it was expressed in feminist terms, not in Christian or religious morality terms. You know, it, the reason that it was kind of worrisome is was always what it meant. If it presented a picture of violence against women or where women had no agency, that was then projected out into the world and made real.
In the book, you sort of go on a journey of discovery. Is a very cliched phrase, but I'm going to use it anyway. You talk to people who work in the industry. Would you say that your views about it had changed, or would you say that, yeah, how would you say you feel about it now, having gone through the book, as it were?
My views changed profoundly. First, just by going to really what was the worst nightmare of an anti-porn feminist, mm-hmm. and this shoot, Public Disgrace at Kink. And the interesting thing about it to me was that this extreme porn was directed by women. And they told me why they were there, and I found the reasons really compelling. You know, one woman said, well, you know, your whole life you're taught to fear. As a woman, you're taught to be scared to go home at night. You're really well-versed in all the horrible things that are always looming that might happen to you. And for her, it was empowering to kind of, like, create a situation where she was, like, living the worst thing that could happen, and but where she had control and could stop and start it, and where she was really the center figure of the all this whole fantasy had been enacted around her, and she got to kind of be in it. So for her, that extremity represented a kind of catharsis, and that was interesting to me. You know, there was also a realization I had that the fact that this existed actually spoke to the power of its own taboo. You know, I don't think that this particular porn actually could exist without feminism, because it was feminism that made it, that articulated everything about it, that made it like a crazy
fantasy. There were guys there who were, I think you're really interesting how you describe this. So there are guys there who are alternating between, like, shouting stuff that I can't say because of our highly valued iTunes clean rating at women, but, you know, and slapping them and spitting on them, and then kind of snapping out of that when the filming stops and feeling and sounding quite kind of ashamed.
Yeah, saying I'll take you to lunch with my mother. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I just think that the whole argument about, and which you go into a bit about this idea about, you know, feminists are essentially accusing women in porn of false consciousness, saying, well, actually, you don't know that this is harming you. I just find that slightly complicated now, because I have always thought that the way that the really extreme porn, you know, these sort of post game interviews where they do, so they were like, hey, you know, what was it like being fisted? And they got, it was amazing being fisted. I really enjoyed it. My worry about that is, though, that I feel that's a much more complicated thing to be joyful about in light of all the allegations against someone like James Dean, for example.
Sure. Yeah, James Dean, the porn actor who was accused of sexual assault and who worked a lot with Kink and was immediately fired, to their credit. But, yeah, it is complicated, and it is... I don't know. I guess the thing when that happened, and maybe this is kind of, I'll be called out on this a little bit, but, you know, that kind of sexual harassment happens at any job. And actually in porn, you know, he got fired right away. At a lot of jobs, you get to keep working. So there's a sense that, I don't know, it shouldn't happen in porn, because they should be more conscious about consent than other communities, because they're...
Yeah.
Have to have those conversations all the time, but...
I think it's a really complicated one, isn't it? Because you're partly saying this is a workplace in which things that just don't happen in... Certainly doesn't happen in the New Statesman office. Conversations like, you know, about people's boundaries are happening. But you're right, in the way that there is actually... I think we can point to any number of... Well, look at Donald Trump, someone who openly boasted about sexual harassment and has received, you know, zero consequences in their career at all.
Well, and that was what was interesting. You know, when the Trump thing happened, I thought a lot about that because what he was describing literally echoed this fantasy that I had been, you know, I'd seen this porn shoot. That was a fantasy they were proposing, was grabbing a woman in public. And it was kind of much scarier that for him to say that and this idea of the locker room, you know, the porn, there was something more, at least in the porn, it was all seen as wicked and horrible. Mm. But it was worse to have a presidential candidate present it as normal and the action of an upstanding citizen. That was more terrifying. And, you know, the porn definitely did not encourage Donald Trump to do that. If anything, the porn, you know, it's not like Donald Trump could ever go up and talk about that porn and be applauded in society for watching it, even though
it was a new and horrifying tweet at 3 a.m.
You know, his version of it is much scarier to me than kink.com's.
Mm. One of the elements of whether or not an industry is progressive, some people would argue, is if you can keep doing it when you're old. Well, I think the person I was most struck by, actually not in the chapter about porn, was Enid, who feels kind of weirdly like a character from the novels of the type of, from her clients. Is that the right word?
Edith, do you mean?
Enid, sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
And the odd thing is she probably couldn't do that if she was old, right? That's not a freedom that you can't, there aren't any, as far as I know, webcam girls in their 40s or 50s, right?
Oh, there definitely are. Yeah.
This is revealing your lack of knowledge of the webcam scene.
No, it was actually surprising. Well, a couple of things on that note. First of all, the porn search term most commonly searched by men in their 60s and above is granny porn. So not because they want grannies, but because they want somebody their own age.
That really, I know that shouldn't be true, but that really cheers me up, right?
Yeah, and it's also one of the reasons that MILF, I think, is such a popular search term. It always tops the list, not because people have mom fantasies, but because that's porn shorthand for a woman over 30. So I actually, you know, it surprises me. It's not as you know, for a lot of men, I think they don't feel great about fantasizing about an 18-year-old. On the other hand, a lot of men do. So
yeah,
but I was surprised in the live webcam. They don't command the same audiences, but there were a lot of women, not a lot, fewer, but there were women that were on there enough that clearly it was working for them in some way, and they were not hot, nubile, young women.
I think that's really interesting because that's also an economic point, I guess, as well, in the sense that when tube sites became popular and free clips and kind of stuff like that, right, that there was just, I think this is, you know, a theme that runs through the book, is this kind of huge abundance, this like ridiculous amount of choice that no other generation has ever had. So the kind of economic response to that is to kind of become a niche, right? It's to, you know, you're the kind of vinyl of porn.
Yeah, exactly.
But did anything else kind of strike you about, did you learn anything else in a sort of political or economic terms about sex that you were surprised by when you were researching this?
Well, when I was, the live webcam thing was really the chapter where I met people from the widest range of economic backgrounds. So a lot of people that didn't go to college and who were doing the thing for money. It spoke a lot to the economic situation in the U.S. right now. First of all, a lot of people were caring for relatives who had health problems. And this was the sexuality that was available to them when they'd had to move back to a small town where there were no other people their age or everybody was married or something. So there was a little bit of that. There were people that, you know, were trying to, you don't really make a lot of money. It's kind of very few people actually make money. But the promise was a job that where you weren't just kind of this corporate drone. And so for some of the younger people, especially doing a crazy sex show was more human to them than going and working at Starbucks where they had to conform to this customer service personality. And I met a lot of, it just really, I just met a lot of people who had really bad medical debt, or they really wanted to go to college, but they just didn't have the money. And so there was a lot of kind of ambitious, clever people that were just dealing with difficult economic circumstances, and this was a sort of stopgap solution for them.
My final question is really, were people's sex lives more or less weird than you expected? Did your view of humanity change by talking to people about stuff that was very intimate and personal?
I mean, really more my view of myself changed, and how I didn't know I was so conservative, in the sense that I just had judged, I guess, you know, for example, people who are in open relationships, I thought of that as kind of a naive, self-destructive thing to pursue, and that it never worked out. And, you know, I just had all these dumb ideas that were not based in my empirical experience, and this sense that people who pursued avid sexual experimentation were all kind of like crazy, or I don't know, it's just judgmental. And then when I got out there, it all made a lot of sense to me and seemed actually highly rational thing to do. And I was embarrassed at my own closed-mindedness. So things that were supposed to be weird actually turned out to feel really not weird. That was the surprise.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. That was Emily Witt, and your book, Future Sex, is available to purchase now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by Helen Lewis and me, Stephen Bush, and produced by India Bork. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.